Today is the full moon day, and according to our calendar, this is the Asala Puja. So this is the day of the anniversary of the Buddha's first teaching, the first explanation of the Middle Way and the Four Noble Truths. Well, probably most of us are familiar with the story, but some of us are probably not. So this festival, this observance day, particularly recollects the time 2 months after the Buddha's enlightenment in Bodh Gaya. And after his enlightenment, he had been moved by compassion and concern for the welfare of other beings, and considered who might possibly understand what he had learned, who might he possibly share the insight into the nature of reality that he had awoken to. And he recollected the five companions with whom he had lived and practiced before he'd gone off to, say, seek the truth on his own. The group of five, his ascetic companions that he had practiced various kinds of austerities, various kinds of self-mortification, various austere practices like eating very little and say driving the body and the mind to its limits of endurance. And he inclining his mind to their whereabouts, then it said that through his psychic abilities had awoken, had arisen at that time, he was able to discern that they were then living in the deer park outside of Varanasi, Benares. So he made his way from Bodh Gaya, walking through the countryside of Bihar, and arriving at the area of Varanasi, and met up with his five former companions. And as it is said, they had previously come to the conclusion that he had given up on the holy life. He had taken to eating normal food and had seemingly abandoned the true ascetic way of liberation. And so they, when they saw him coming, they saw him arriving and walking towards them, their initial thought was, well, there's that useless wastrel Gotama who used to be our teacher and our leader, and the one who gave up on spiritual life, who, lost the track, lost the true path, and instead took a way of comfort, a way of self-indulgence. So as he was approaching, then as the story goes, they made the agreement to not to rise up to meet him or not to pay any respect to him. But as he approached, then they were unable to stop themselves, that they were so moved by his presence, and just their own intuitive wisdom caused them to you know, jump up and move towards him, to pay respects and to offer him some water and refreshment and a place to sit down. So then the Buddha began to explain to them, or to speak with them, and saying to them how during the time that he had left their company and gone off on his own, that he had indeed awakened to the Dhamma, he'd awakened to the deathless reality. He had truly realized that and now knew it and was completely attuned to that reality. And at first they didn't believe him and said, well, how can that possibly be the case? How could you be enlightened? You know, that's ridiculous, because you gave up. You just were eating ordinary food and living the high life, you know, indulging in porridge, milk rice, and having a nice time by the river, just say living in comfort, and you know, you've given up the ascetic path. So how could it possibly be that you've been enlightened? And then they went back and forth three times, as we always do in the Buddhist tradition. Everything is always done three times over, just for good measure. And so after the third time, the Buddha then said to them, "Friends, have I ever spoken to you in this way before?" And they said, "No, indeed, friend, you have not." He said, "Well, listen, let me tell you that the deathless has been realized. And if you listen to me, if you pay attention, then in no long time, you too can awaken to that same reality. You too can have this same experience of full and complete liberation. So do you want to hear what I have to say?" And eventually they realized, okay, yeah, he's never talked like this, and he does look really different. And just the sheer power of the Buddha's presence, that the newly awakened Buddha, there was, even though he was like them, just dressed in the same rag robes of the wandering ascetics, and would have been sun-baked and lean from living in the outdoors, there was an incredible brightness and a peacefulness. There was a presence to him that they had never seen before, and that was something that was extraordinarily impactful, powerful, and told them, "Look, this is not ordinary. There is a change here. You are now meeting something that is very, very different, and you've not met this before, so pay attention." So if we consider this, you know, that 2,600 years ago, on this night, this full moon night, however many moons ago that was, 30,000 moons or so, the small group of six people gathered together in this park outside of Benares. And one can still go there today. There's now the ruins of a great stupa that was there, and the outlines of the ancient viharas and dwelling places of the monastic communities that were established around there. You can still go there to that spot. So it still exists, the very place where that teaching was given. The Dhammik stupa is the place that marks the very spot where the Buddha gave that teaching, so it is said. And if we consider, these are words that describe events of legend off in the remote past, and it can all seem very, very distant or abstract. But if we consider it, this actually took place, this exchange, or something very, very like it, took place 2,600 years ago, 26 centuries ago. And what was happening here in Great Ganson 2,600 years ago? It's probably a very, very rough rural life, if there's a human habitation around here, living in grass huts and mud huts and little shelters. And in the era of the Iron Age times, Ivanhoe Beacon was probably the local sort of stronghold, a big Iron Age fort on up at around Ivanhoe and that area. But very rough and rudimentary life that was being lived here in England at that time. But this exchange in that very era, that very time, taking place in the park outside of Varanasi, and then all these years later, 26 centuries later, the resonances, the ripples from that exchange, are still have reached all the way over here and are affecting us, this very day, this very time, affecting and guiding our lives all these years later. This is a miraculous and an amazing thing. To me, when you really consider this, gathered together in a small cluster of six lean ascetics in a piece of parkland outside of Varanasi in India, and 26 centuries later, our lives here in England, in this part of the world, have been so strongly affected that we build our lives around that. These are the forces, the principles that guide our everyday actions, our speech, our way of living, our whole way of conducting ourselves in the world. This is extraordinary, that the strength and the beauty, the potency of that particular teaching. And during that exposition, that as we recited at the beginning of this evening, the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha spells out the middle way, describes the nature of the middle way. First of all, he says, you know, what is the middle way? The middle way is samadhiti, samasankapo, and so on, and describes the Eightfold Path. So in that he points out the Eightfold Path is the middle way. The middle way is the Eightfold Path. How we live in such a way that our life is in perfect attunement with reality, in perfect attunement with Dhamma. And that teaching was given on that very first day when he started his teaching career, and the Sangha was born at that time, and the first of the other human beings were able to understand his teaching, when Kandanya of that group was the first one to understand, to really comprehend and take to heart what the Buddha said, and to be changed, to enter the stream at that point. That even though that was the very first teaching that was given, it's also extraordinary and wonderful that throughout his whole life that the Buddha just really stayed within the bounds of that same teaching, that framework of the Four Noble Truths created the format and the structure for all of his teachings that came after. So it wasn't as though at that first time he gave the preliminary teachings and then the sort of higher, more esoteric and special teachings came later on, even though some Buddhist traditions claim that, certainly within the Southern Buddhist school, within this lineage of the Southern Buddhist world. It's recognized that right there in that very first teaching, the whole thing was encompassed, that everything that could be said that was useful in a way was spelled out right there in that very first teaching, just as in a book or a story, you know, sometimes the first sentence, the first paragraph can encompass the entirety of the story that's coming, and let you know what the scope of the whole thing is there. The Buddha did that same thing with the Four Noble Truths. And later on, there was the simile of the elephant's footprint was given, that where describing the Four Noble Truths, he said it's like the just as the elephant's footprint is bigger than the footprint of every other animal in the forest, that whether it's a buffalo or a tiger or a lion or a horse or a cow, any other large creature, you know, all of those footprints are smaller than they're contained within the scope of the elephant's footprint. So too, the Four Noble Truths is a description of the full range and scope of the teaching. Every other teaching is subsidiary to that. Every other teaching, every other skillful means, every other method that is taught and described within the Buddha Sasana is contained within that fundamental outline, the fundamental framework of the Four Noble Truths. This is extraordinary, yeah, and quite wonderful, really. And that, but it also reflects the all-encompassing nature of the Buddha's enlightenment, and that the clarity of his wisdom that was able to formulate and clarify that right from the very beginning, and to spell that out, like, you know, this is all you need to know. And that was so clear and so total and so completely in tune with the nature of things, so completely in accord with reality. That it was like the voice of reality speaking, as it were. He never needed to supersede that or say adjust it or change the scope as the years went by, and as experience has shown over all these 26 centuries, you know, still the scope is of the Four Noble Truths is all that we truly need. Now, as he said on another occasion, it's because of not understanding four things that you and I and all beings have had to travel and trudge through this endless round of births and deaths, the long round of samsara. Through not understanding four things, that all, you know, all beings are continually born and dying, reborn and redying. And these four are the nature of dukkha, of suffering, of dissatisfaction, of its cause, of the cessation of dukkha, the possibility of that dissatisfaction coming to an end, coming to a complete conclusion, and the way in which that concluding of an ending of suffering is brought about. It's because of not understanding that we keep being reborn, and when that is understood, then rebirth stops. So this is an extraordinary and wonderful principle to reflect on, and also how when people ask the Buddha about, well, surely there must be more to it than that. I mean, you have this incredible powers, and every once in a while then there are these say references or there are these allusions to different realities, different realms of being, and the extraordinary patterns of karma that different beings go through over the flow of many, many lifetimes, and all of these extraordinary and intricate details of how the universe works. I mean, you know all this stuff, you understand all this stuff. What is the ultimate origin of things, or what is the nature of an enlightened being after the body dies? Surely you must be able to describe all these things, you must know these things. And what's the nature, the relationship between the individual and the universe and the karma of all beings and such like? And over and over again the Buddha refused to answer these speculative or metaphysical questions. That when people asked him about these kind of mysteries of the universe and all of the complex details about how life and the cycles of birth and death work, he just would refuse to answer. And over and over again he would frustrate the people who were coming to see him. So sometimes people felt, well, if he understood, then he would say, because it must be that he doesn't understand, he's just faking it, he's just pretending. He just has this reputation of being somebody who understands, but actually he doesn't really, and he's just got a good front. So he's sort of getting away with it, but really he hasn't got a clue, he's just as lost as the rest of us. And the Buddha would quite quietly and politely say, no. No, I do understand these things, but I don't talk about them, because they're not things that are of benefit. They are not things that lead to liberation. They are not things that lead to true peacefulness. Particularly with this exchange with Malunkyaputta, when the Buddha was challenged by him, and Malunkyaputta said, "Look, you know all these things. I'm sure you know all these things, and if you don't." I'm getting really annoyed, I'm getting very frustrated that you never let on about all this esoteric knowledge that I'm sure you have, and you could pass that on, it would make things much easier, much more interesting, much more useful for the rest of us, and it would really give us faith in the holy life that we're living. So why don't you tell us all these wonderful things that you're supposed to know about? And in fact, if you don't tell me, I'm going to disrobe, so there. A kind of 3-year-old having a tantrum, I'm going to hold my breath till I explode, so there, yeah. So that the Buddha said, well, Malunkyaputta, was it the case that when you became a monk that we made an agreement that if you received the full acceptance as a bhikkhu, then I would answer these metaphysical questions for you about the ultimate origin of the universe, or the nature of the karma of all beings and so on, or what happens to an enlightened being when the body dies. Did we make that an agreement of that nature? And Malunkyaputta said, well, no. Said, well, so what are you doing now? Sort of threatening trying to threaten me with you disrobing and leaving the community if I don't tell you. This is ridiculous and pointless. He said, what I have revealed, he said, that what has been revealed, let leave that as being revealed. What I have left as unrevealed, please leave that as unrevealed. And what I have not revealed, why have I not revealed it? I've not revealed it, these all these kind of metaphysical facts or this esoteric knowledge about the universe and the nature of karma and the different levels of being and the ultimate origin of things. So I haven't talked about it, I don't speak of that, because it doesn't lead towards peace, it doesn't lead towards clarity, it doesn't lead towards, say, the ending of dukkha. And so that's why I don't talk about it. I said, but what I do, what I have revealed, is what leads to peace, what leads to understanding, what leads to clarity, what leads to true liberation. And what have I taught? What have I revealed? I revealed the nature of dukkha, the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. That's what I've revealed. So this can be kind of frustrating, and we can think, oh yeah, Four Noble Truths. Yeah, I read about that in the Introduction to Buddhism, Chapter 1. Yeah, that's easy to understand. Okay, got that. But it's important to take this really to heart, that when the Buddha said it's because of not understanding four things that we are unenlightened, and if we truly understand those four things, then that is synonymous, that's the same thing as liberation. If that's truly understood, if we really know what these things are and how they work, then the heart is liberated. So in the giving of the first teaching there in the deer park in Varanasi, that day with Kandanya and Vadiya, Mahanama, Vapa, and Asaji, the five companions that the Buddha had, and that was the first instruction that he gave, and Kandanya was the first one who understood. And as it says in the sutta, Anyasi Vatabho Kandanya, when the Buddha realizes that Kandanya's got the point, he sees what the Buddha's talking about, then the Buddha exclaims, Anyasi Vatabho Kandanya. Kandanya understands, he's got it. And that it's also very striking that when he understands and becomes a stream enterer, in that point that his insight, his understanding becomes irreversible into the Dhamma, the way it's characterized is also equally unremarkable. Just as we can intellectually comprehend the Four Noble Truths, so that, you know, there is the noble truth of dukkha, there is the experience of dissatisfaction, we're less than totally happy all of the time, okay, understand that. That the cause of that, the dissatisfaction, is craving, you know, self-centered desire, okay, can comprehend that, yeah, not difficult. Yeah, this dissatisfaction can come to an end. It can have a complete conclusion. It can come to a complete cessation. Okay, yeah, that sounds reasonable. That can happen, and the way to bring it to that complete cessation is this Eightfold Path. Oh, well, that sounds reasonable. Okay, so intellectually, it's not difficult to comprehend or make sense of. And similarly, when Kandanya sees that and recognizes it, when the way that formulates itself in his mind, the way that the insight crystallizes within him in seeing that truth is equally simple. Yankinchi dhammo samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. Yankinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. Whatever is subject to arising is also subject to cessation. Again, that was in the chanting of the sutta as we had it. So this is intellectually not a stretch. Whatever arises passes away. Whatever begins ends. What goes up must come down. You know, it's a very basic, simple, you know, concept. A three-year-old can understand it. It's not a difficult thing. But yet, it's because the heart does not really comprehend that. We don't really take in the implications of that. That there is still the bondage of our heart to birth and death. The heart is still bound to dukkha, to the endless cycles of becoming and of dissatisfaction. So these teachings, they take contemplation, they take, let's say, a studied reflection, and we need to pick them up and look at them and say, well, when we consider dukkha, what is that? When we consider craving, what is that? Or cessation of dukkha, what is that? We talk about the Eightfold Path, or summarizing that as sila, samadhi, and panya, virtue, concentration, and wisdom. What is that? Then it takes that an effort to not just carry around the concept, but to pick it up and explore it, to really open that up. And so this is, say, as part of our meditation, and that the process of using our meditation to truly liberate the heart, that's something that we need to do. It doesn't just happen on its own. If we are extremely ready, like obviously Kandanya was ready, and then later on when the Buddha gave the teaching on the three characteristics, that later on that same group gathered together there in the Deer Park, the Buddha gave the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, then all five of the companions became fully enlightened arahants. So they were primed, they were well and truly ready. But those of us 26 centuries later, most of us are not quite so ready, not quite so primed. And it doesn't just take the sound of a single Dhamma talk that takes 15 or 20 minutes to recite, that suddenly we're hopping off the wheel with alacrity. It's not just so easy. So we need to create that ripeness, that readiness, that primedness. It needs to be developed within us. That needs to be something that we work at. So in the meditation, and then during this coming rains retreat, those of us who will be here for this 3-month period, we'll be having times of a group retreat beginning on Monday, and then times for individual solo retreats. And these are this retreat times in particular are prime opportunities to pick up these basic principles, these sort of core essential principles of the teaching, and to look, what is this? When we use these words, and then we use them so much, and we've heard them for so many years, 2, 3, 4 decades, the mind can just become completely numb to them. We've heard it so many times. It's so familiar. We even explained it so many times that it just doesn't sink in. We just repeat the sounds, or we just repeat the concept. And it's become completely dead and sort of frozen, just sort of stuck in a shell. But we have to break open the shell and say, well, when I say impermanent, when I say anicca, what is that? You say, whatever arises passes away. Now, why is that so important, and how do I not see that? Or what is the way that works? What's the experience of anicca, of uncertainty? What is that? How do I feel that? We have to actively pick it up and explore it, because it won't enlighten us on our own. It's like a key. You have to actually pick the key up and put it in the lock and turn it in order to make it work. You can't just think, okay, great key, it opens the door, yep, that's what it does. And then just leave the key hanging on a hook and not using it. We actually have to pick it up and put it in the right lock and turn it, and then we can get through. So this is the way it is with our experience, moment to moment, learning to recognize, oh, this is dukkha, or this is the ending of dukkha, this is the heart free from dukkha, this is what it feels like. This is the heart bound up with dukkha, this is what it feels like. Oh, this is the experience of craving. It's got this quality, this particular type of craving, this particular form of identification. It has this particular pattern. Aha, that's what it is. So it takes a very active and engaged interest. We have to get motivated within ourselves to not just be going along with the routine, or following the list of things that we're supposed to be doing, or what the schedule tells us to do. But we have to, within that framework, within the scope of our days, we have to be taking that action, the picking up our moment-to-moment experience and exploring it, looking at it. And this is what right view, samaditti, the very first element of the Eightfold Path. This is what is right view. Right view is seeing the Four Noble Truths. And it doesn't just, when it says, you know, seeing the Four Noble Truths is the substance of right view. It doesn't just mean, oh, I believe the Four Noble Truths are true. you know, on a very superficial level, that's what that means. But right view, seeing clearly, what that means is seeing through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, just as if we were wearing glasses, spectacles, that had four lenses, if you like, so that we're looking through the lenses of the Four Noble Truths. That's the way we're seeing the world, so that we're, in a sense, reframing. So we're not seeing the observance night in the temple, or we're not seeing the tidying our room, or we're not seeing putting our shoes on, or we're not seeing the nighttime or the daytime or the summertime or the sunshine or the rain. But we're not seeing a conversation or seeing happiness or unhappiness, seeing success or failure, praise or criticism. What we're seeing is dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, magga. What we're seeing is, oh, this is dukkha. This is the cause of it. This is the ending of it. This is the way leading to the end of it. So that we're, in a sense, taking that everyday moment-to-moment experience and learning to look at it through that lens. So we need to say consciously withdraw our attention from the content of experience and look at the very process of it. Look at the very the nature of the attitude that is present. And that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of application, and a lot of the time, you know, it's just too much work. we you know, it's easier just to sort of switch off and just go along with the routine and activities and this the flow of habit. That's very normal, very ordinary for us. But that's not going to liberate us. Even if we follow the flow of habit and the routine of the monastery very precisely, even if we're very obedient to the schedule and what we should do at different times of each day and the different forms we should follow in the shrine room or in the kitchen or in the sangha meetings and around the garden or the office or wherever we work. It's not just a matter of being obedient to the patterns. Even though that's useful and good and sets an appropriate form, a harmonious form in place, unless we take the action to pick up our experience moment by moment and notice, this is what's happening right now. I'm experiencing dukkha. This is the feeling of being with what I don't want. This is the feeling of being separated from what I do want, separated from what I like. This is the feeling of not getting what I want. Aha, this is dukkha, okay. Being with that ache in the knee, being with that tedious mind state, being, on the receiving end of some criticism, or being overwhelmed by a feeling of greed or selfishness. You know, the attention, our eye, is drawn towards the content, isn't it? We're drawn to the thing that we're feeling greedy for. We're drawn to the thing that we're annoyed by. We're drawn to the believing in the mood of I can't stand this. I had enough of this. Or wow, I could really do with some more of that. Or this is mine. The attention goes directly to the object, doesn't it? That's the habit that we all have. The object that is frightening us, the object that is annoying us, the object that is being owned by us, the object that's being desired by us, the object that's familiar to us or strange to us, that's the habit. And then we invest that object with purpose and meaning and value. And we miss the attitude with which we're relating to it. We miss the tension that is built up in the heart in the way that we relate to that. But to see through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, to establish right view, to in a way bring the heart into alignment, into attunement with Dhamma, then the Buddha advises, and what we can see through direct experience is that when we take the trouble to activate ourselves, this is the experience when you let go of craving, it feels like this. Oh, right, really nice. This is good. When the heart is free from clinging, this is what it feels like. When we let go of something, to just notice that. Dukkha Nirodha. Ah, I drop the clinging, I let go, and having let go, this is what the heart feels like. Ah. So there in the description of the Four Noble Truths, in the outlining of each of the truths, we have the direct instruction of how to work with them. And those of us who've been around Lumpur Sumedho for many years will have heard him over and over again talking about these details, the four truths, and then the three modes of working with each truth, so that dukkha, the experience of dissatisfaction, is to be understood, to be apprehended, to recognize, oh, this is dukkha, this is what's happening. It's like separation from the liked, dukkha, okay, right. I'm not going to get that thing that I wanted, or I'm going to be stuck with this thing that I don't want, this 3-day headache, or this being given the room that I really didn't want for the rains retreat. Okay, here it is. This is association with the disliked. It's dukkha. Aha. Separation from the liked is dukkha. Aha. So seeing that, dukkha is understood, is apprehended. And then the cause of dukkha, craving, pahata banti, needs to be let go of, should be let go of. Pahanati is to abandon, to let go of, to relinquish. So, okay, then having seen that that's been, that's the cause of it, is that there's a clinging going on, there's a craving, then it needs to be let go of, and then the dukkha nirodha, sacchikata banti, should be realized. So what that means is when we have let go, when the heart releases and relinquishes that, then we have to notice that, because if we don't consciously notice that, if we don't bring to mind, oh, this is what it feels like when the heart is not clinging, then we miss it. We overlook that, because peace is not interesting. And again, this is something that gets said over and over and over, is endlessly repeated. I've heard Lumpur Sumedho say it numerous times. I've heard myself say it hundreds of times. But yet, isn't it amazing how easy it is to miss it? That when we let go of something, and we drop some opinion, we drop some obsession, we drop some fear or some aversion, that we don't take the trouble to notice the quality of the heart free from that clinging, because that is not grabbing our attention. Peace does not grab our attention. Space and silence do not compel the mind. So we skip over that and get on to the next interesting thing, the next thing that I want that I haven't got, or the next thing that I need to do, or the next thing that I've got to become, or I've got to get rid of. So we, even though on one level we might come to a place like Amaravati because, oh, I really want peace, I need peace in my life, I need to find contentment, satisfaction, all I really want is peace. That's what I want. And yet, when it arrives, we don't even notice it. We just overlook it. We miss it because it's not compelling. It's like that. It's often easiest to notice it when a plane flies over on the way to Luton Airport, or we're in a room with a refrigerator that's humming, and then the fridge stops its little hum. They go, oh. Or the traffic going past the window comes to a stop, or there is no vehicles going by, and I hadn't even noticed that there was a stream of traffic, hadn't even noticed that the fridge was on. And then just for a second, 2 or 3 seconds, well, that's nice. And then 3 seconds go by and what's the next thing? Yeah. How long does that sweetness of the fridge, the silence of the fridge, sustain itself for? It doesn't say stay sweet or compelling for very long, does it? We hardly notice it because the mind is immediately pulled towards the next interesting thing. So to notice, to realize dukkha nirodha, even though that sounds quite grand or sort of special, it's in a way that's exactly the same quality of when a thought comes to an end, a mood comes to an end, the sound of the fridge comes to an end, the plane flies past. To be able to stay with that silence and to let that really blossom in the heart, to stay with that spaciousness, and not to let it be filled up with some other activity, some other thought, some other object, but to truly know, to, you know, Satchikata Bhante, to truly realize, to know, to awaken to the full reality of what is here when the heart is free from clinging, to know that deathless reality, to know the real Amaravati, the deathless realm. Because that is what is realized, that's what's present, that's what's known when the heart frees itself from clinging. And then the fourth truth is to be cultivated, Bhaveta Bhanti. The Eightfold Path is to be cultivated. So, just in this speaking about right view, this is to be cultivated, bhavana, to be developed. It's not just going to do it on its own, it's work. It's something that needs, a thing that needs to be done. It's an activity that needs to be followed. Effort needs to be made, guided in the right way by wisdom and mindfulness. And then when we truly establish right view, when we see the world through the lens of these Four Noble Truths, when we are able to see in this way, then even though it might, you know, like a pair of glasses is not anything that's particularly mind-blowing or special, it doesn't, you know, captivate our attention. But when we put them on, oh look, if we're short-sighted or long-sighted or we have astigmatism or some distortion in our own lenses, when we put the glasses on, oh look, suddenly the world takes shape in a balanced and integrated, a sharp-edged, clear way. And exactly the same fashion when we put on the lenses of the Four Noble Truths, and we see, then we get right view. That's 20/20 vision. We can see clearly that, and that, and when there is clear vision, and we allow what is seen to really sink into the heart, to really be known by the heart, then that heart changes. And this is when we are reciting these teachings in that same section where the Buddha is describing the three aspects of the Four Noble Truths. We have this endless, over and over again, the repeated udapadis, chakung udapadi, jnanang udapadi, panya udapadi, vijja udapadi, aloko udapadi. These are all similes of vision and seeing. Chakung udapadi, vision arose. Chaku is the eye. Chakung udapadi, jnanang, knowledge arose. Panya, wisdom arose. Vijja, knowing or awareness arose. Aloka, light arose. These are all words that allude to light and vision and seeing. You know, over and over and over again, that's the fundamental image of enlightenment, when we use the English word enlightenment, making the light conscious, embodying that light of wisdom and awareness. So when we do this, then the world is truly seen as it is, and that's that true seeing, that seeing clearly, that is what changes the heart. So it's like seeing the nature of a puzzle when you recognize how a say a puzzle works, or when your eyes were blurry and you couldn't make out the shapes, and you put on your glasses and you, oh, I see. Or the fog clears and the edges are defined. Oh, I see what it was. It wasn't a tree, it was a car. Oh, no, that was the edge of the building. Oh, that was a person. Oh, now I see. Then that change in the heart, that we don't have to make that happen. That's the natural automatic result of the clear seeing. We don't have to will it. I don't have to make it happen. But simply by the clarification of vision, then that's what comes about. So the occasion tonight, Asala Puja, this is a night to reflect on these Four Noble Truths and to take the opportunity to consider the significance, the incredible value that these teachings have, that these are very simple, very direct, and also it's an opportunity to set that resolve to see things in this way, to not just sort of go along with wishful thinking, or not just praise these. Oh, isn't it wonderful how the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths and never apply them? It's like, oh, this is a wonderful key that'll open the way to happiness, and we hang it on the wall and worship it. But instead, you should take the key and put it in the lock and let ourselves out of the prison. That's what it's for. So that this is a time to reflect on these truths, to reflect on how, having given this simple instruction, then the miracle of instruction that the Buddha brought about was then bringing into being the understanding, or catalyzing, initiating the understanding of his friends, causing them to awaken, and how that awakening and that crystallization of understanding in these few words just takes 20 minutes to recite the whole sutta. How we are the recipients, we are the beneficiaries. We receive the benefits of those simple words, and the power and the accuracy, the true value of those words coming down through 26 centuries to the present day. This is a miraculous thing, that right here and now, in this very life of ours, in this very mind, in this very heart, in this place, those same words that were first expressed or first formulated 2,600 years ago in the deer park in Varanasi, all those thousands of miles away, in a very, very different world, a world that will incomparably change from what we experience here in Britain today. It's the words that were formulated then, right now, a cause for liberation, for clarity, for clear seeing within ourselves. This is truly an extraordinary thing. The Buddha said there were two kinds of miracles: the miracle of psychic power, of iddhi, and the miracle of instruction. And the miracle of instruction, he pointed out, is by far the superior of these two. So I would encourage us on this occasion, this night, and as we set out on this next 3-month period of the Rains Retreat, formally beginning tomorrow evening, we can take this as an opportunity to pick up these four truths, these utterly simple, unremarkable, easily comprehensible ideas, these simple principles. We can use this as an opportunity to pick these up, to explore them, to investigate how they work, how come they are so important, and see for ourselves how, when they are applied, they do make such a difference. And when we establish right view, then when we see clearly, then this is truly how we can conduct ourselves more easefully, more harmoniously, more effectively in the world. The Buddha said that just as the lightning of the sky in the dawn heralds the rising of the sun. It's the forerunner of the rising of the sun. So too, right view is the forerunner, the herald of all wholesome states. So, which is a very important and helpful image, that like the lightning of the sky in the early dawn, that tells you, oh, the sun's going to come up. Yeah, we're going to see clearly. So too, right view, that is the forerunner of all wholesome states. So that with that in place, then all good things come from that. Yeah, so that the more that we can establish that right view as our basic relationship and basic attitude, the way that we meet the world, the eyes through which we see the world, and we see our own lives, our own bodies, our own minds, then everything good will follow from that. All good, all that which is of true value and meaning will come from that. And this is not just the statement of the Buddha, but also we can see this for ourselves. We can look and we can know this truly and directly for ourselves to find out if this is true. Is it the fact? And then as we see that an experience shows us, yeah, this is the fact, then let that again sink in, let that have its effect and say, okay, if that's that being the case, then let right view be more fully cultivated, developed and established, so that then that vision is, that clarity of vision is sustained. That clarity of vision is something that maintains itself and is enabled to continue to bring blessings and to ripen in those qualities of full liberation, to take this path to its ending. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Karanda Dhamma Se Sa.